Privilege is all around you. It shows up in your clothes, where you live, the places you frequent, your network capital, and even how you spend your money. It's useless until you recognize it. So it's time to stop feeling guilty and figure out how to use your privilege to make an impact. Welcome to Guilty Privilege. Because I consider you to be the person I go to about equity, mm-hmm. I would love for you to clarify one thing. You make a very pointed effort, and I appreciate this too, mm-hmm. to make sure that people understand that you do equity, you do not do DEI.
Right.
Can you explain the difference and why it's important that you call that out?
For me, and you know this, mm-hmm. I come into equity work not from a perspective of looking at it as a workplace issue.
Right.
I come into it looking at it from a legal issue and from a research issue.
Yes.
So for me, equity has always been described as something you measure. It's always been described as something that has a historical significance to marginalization. And, you know, having experience in human and civil rights law, it mm-hmm. always centers the intersection of non-white communities and especially Black communities that at one point in time were legally declared not to be human.
Exactly.
Right? We have yet still reached full humanity for Blackness. Mm-hmm. So for me, equity is not achieved until that has actually been both the priority and the center of this work. So when I see D&I, D&I has a necessary function and is mm-hmm. also an extension of, if we're going to be honest, so many different remedies that have tried, especially when it came to labor, to mm-hmm. remedy the disenfranchisement of specifically Black people.
Right.
And the frustration that I have about D&I Light is that D&I Light is often not centered on the failed attempts of our civil rights laws,
right.
the failed attempt of affirmative action, the failed attempt of individuals getting out of the way and letting those who have experienced the harm lead the work.
Correct.
So as long as it's called D&I and it's led by people that don't center that, I don't do that work.
Yes.
That's why I make a clear distinction as to what I do versus what is out there.
Exactly.
Asterisk, as you know, D&I has also evolved because of Black femme folk
yes.
that have been doing this work. So I'm also always advocating for those such as yourself, and at times an extension of some of the work that I have to do
yes.
To call out that those who do D&I work through a justice and equity lens are very different than those who do D&I because they want to celebrate somebody for a month.
Correct. So I appreciate you making the distinction, because throughout this podcast, I've made a point to use the word equity because I want folks to understand the conversations we're having are about bringing equity to a something, whether that's equity right. in education or equity in information or equity in whatever, whomever the expert is that I'm speaking to. Mm-hmm. And in your case, I was like, well, is it equity of equity? Like, what do I say? Because but it's tricky because equity is one of those things that, to your point, because we haven't achieved it and it's so messed up from the law standpoint,
right.
from how we define it, how it does, or in many cases does not show up in the spaces that we frequent, mm-hmm. in our Black bodies and whatever identities, honestly, I do think that it puts us in the position of wondering where does equity education begin?
Like, right.
does it start at home? Is it my teachers? Where should I have started to get this? Where should I be expecting to learn about what equity is? Because I know that the people I talk to say they are learning it from me. And I would imagine that that's what's happening a lot of time for you. Mm-hmm. So DEI costs dollars, but it isn't just about the dollars. And so I would love to just kind of get some perspective from you about some other ways to keep diversity, equity, and inclusion at the top of mind, or what maybe you do in your role to kind of make sure that it's still in focus, even when the budget dollars are shifting.
Yeah, no, great. Well, let me talk about budget first before I move to the other things you do in lieu of budget.
Yeah.
You're right. DEI as a department, as a function in an organization, that budget is never enough. It should never,
it's never enough.
But what I will say is, you know, I use other people's money, right? I use procurement's money yeah. to help with supplier diversity, right? I use marketing's dollars to help with anything experiential or event driven, right? It's really how you tap into the rest of the organization to actually invite them into the DEI experience. We can't do this alone as a DEI practitioner, the same way I can't solely use my budget.
That's
alone,
right.
Right. And so how you engage other areas of the business and how you engage other departments to really drive the mission of DEI is critical. With that though, you then have to make sure you're tracking to their ROI,
not just your own,
right? Exactly. Because now they're engaged. Now they're invested, literally, financially invested. You also then have to make sure you're giving them the impact that they need to see. I think impact in any organization shows up in a variety of ways, right? It is about how do you make the workforce more diverse? So for example, at LVMH, one of the first things I did was put in a goal for the organization to increase the number of people of color in executive positions.
Yes.
And we set a target and we set a timeline in which we want to see that shift. The reason I wanted to do it at the executive level is diversity begets diversity.
That's right.
Right? So if you put more women at the top, they're going to hire more women.
That's
you put
right.
more people of color at the top, they're going to hire more people of color. Doing it at the lower ends of the organization is important, but it doesn't have the same impact
That's right.
and trickle down effect as if you do it at the higher ends of the organization. So that was really key. But again, it's really about explaining to people, this work doesn't only fall on my shoulders because I have the title.
Correct.
Right? I talk to our chief marketing officers. I talk to our heads of HR. I'm talking to legal and finance about all these things that impact their area to see how we can improve it. So how do you impact workforce? How do you shift corporate culture? Again, what is the marketing strategy? And the optics on what marketing looks like and how we're going out with our storytelling and what we tell the world. Because the other disconnect for me is marketing is operating over here doing a bunch of storytelling. What I really try to explain to them is the images and storytelling that you put out into the world actually impacts who would potentially apply for a job. If you don't see yourself reflected in our brands, why would you even think you could work there?
Yeah.
So marketing and HR are actually very connected.
Very
People think
connected.
That they're not
That's
because
right.
they're very different functions in the organization. But I'm like, marketing's doing all the storytelling.
That's right.
Again, if I can go
That's
to
how
Instagram.
I'm gonna check you out.
Right.
Yeah.
Right? That's how I'm gonna do all my research.
That's right.
And so I know marketing is in theory about the product, but it also affects our workforce as well. So those conversations, you know, have to be intentional around what is our storytelling? What is our brand? What are we trying to communicate to the world? And by doing that, it also highlights what we actually care about.
That's right. So what do you think that we need? We were talking about how Black women aren't well represented in this space. Mm-hmm. What do you think is necessary to make it more equitable?
So, I mean, something that you often talk about, allies and advocates,
That's it.
Right? And the difference between the two, because oftentimes, sometimes, you know, your skin folk, right?
That part, not your kinfolk.
Not your kinfolk.
That's right.
Right.
You gotta be willing to diversify the folks you're asking.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So, and we have been taught this, and I do think it's true, more diverse fund managers equate to more money for Black founders and others. However, we can't just depend on that.
That's right.
Right? Who's writing the checks like does matter, but we also need for you also to write a check to us, Jim.
Yeah. Yeah, correct. Don't just refer me.
Right, don't refer me.
I want you to also write the check.
I need for you to also write a check.
So the thing about being an ally or being an advocate is when you take the action, it encourages others to take the action.
Yes.
So you referring me to someone is one thing, but you telling someone I invested in,
yes.
I am recommending this person for you to invest in, is really going to be the more impactful action.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. I remember when I was raising my seed round, a white investor by the name of Tim Milliken from TPG Capital, which is a large PE firm, private equity firm, met up with me for lunch and he said, oh, I'm going to put a check into your company. And it wasn't even a large check. I'm talking about like $35,000, which is not large for someone for in private equity,
exactly,
right?
Yes.
However, he was writing an angel check into my round. And because his name was on my cap table, literally, it was like a call to all these other investors.
Yes.
And others came in with much larger checks because they saw his name on my cap table.
That's right. This is what allyship and advocacy is about. It's using the power you have to be able to influence the change you want to see.
Yeah.
So just the willingness to say, I'm going to make sure that this shows up this way made all the difference. I love that. Amazing. Just to jump in, you have it's EduColor.
Yes.
Just to make sure that it's like the color part matters.
Oh, yeah.
And so I just want to like zoom in on that aspect for a moment, because one of the things I love about EduColor is that it prioritizes centering the identities of people of color, not just the student, but also the teachers. Can you talk a little bit about why it's important for both the students, but also for the teachers and also for us in the community to be a part of, you know, an educational equity experience, or at least thinking about educational equity? I mean, as you know, I don't have kids, but I still care a lot about this, but why should we?
What we notice over time, and of course myself being a Black Latinx man, but also any number of people who I've spoken to, is that we put race first because we wanted to ensure that that was spoken about. So if we said all other things were equal, then race would still play a large factor into how people actually treated us. So for example, in the disability community, there's a big conversation as to who gets treated and how. So often we notice that the Black students were getting referred to, you know, special ed, so on and so forth, because it was a form of detention, it was a form of confinement, as opposed to those who were white students that were getting the same labels. They were getting longer time to do their tests. They were getting extended treatment. They were treated in many ways with kid gloves, right?
Privilege.
And, right, that would be that. And so that was happening all across the board, you know, well, white women versus Black women, so on and so forth. And it isn't just white and Black, but yes, like even when you look at differentials between like who makes what monies and who gets to work where, Black women administrators have struggling in different capacities in the way that their white male counterparts don't.
Yeah.
And so even when you get to those upper echelons, you still see those racial dynamics happening. And so EduColor wanted to focus on that color part because we recognized that that coalition was powerful. And it was a way for us to elevate a lot of these racial biases, but also racial triumphs and the ways that we can actually win through the cultures and elevate culture in the way that we do.
I do think sometimes we get a little bit of push. And in fact, I've talked about this in some other episodes of the podcast, how we are brown girls do ballet and how sometimes we get pushback about specifically the word girls.
Yes.
What are your thoughts about that?
I think I always go back to why I started this. Because it was for a girl. It was for my girl.
Right.
But now it serves so many other girls around the world. And then you think about the word women. When a girl becomes a woman, she is like an owner of her life, her agency for the most part, and she knows where she wants to go.
Right.
We're dealing with girls who do not for the most part. Now, some of them come to us like together. I have a plan.
That's true.
I need you to help me execute it.
Here is where I would like to go. I want to go to this school.
Exactly.
This is what I want to do after school.
Exactly.
Yes.
But I think that when I think of brown girls, it is for young girls.
Right.
Now, we are very blessed in the fact that we have girls that will come to us as young as 10 and never leave us. So I still have brown girls who do ballet who are like 24 now.
That's true. That's true. They are brown women.
They're brown ballet. Women.
And some of them I've gone on from not just doing ballet. We have other dances and other art forms too, which is also really amazing.
Yeah.
I love that about ballet specifically, is that it's a great foundational.
It is. Yeah. It is. And it's one of those things, if you know from probably around the age of 12 or 13, if ballet is going to be the thing that you do.
That's true.
If you're going to want to go to eventually dance at New York City Ballet or ABT, you know that very young. We have a lot of girls who come to us as 17-year-olds who love dance, who love ballet.
That's right.
But know physically, it may not be for them.
Yeah.
So we have been fortunate enough to be able to connect them with other professionals mm-hmm. that expose them to other ways that they can still be attached to dance, yep. but not maybe be a dancer or on stage. Yeah. So we have a lot of girls that are in college now getting degrees and looking at things like arts administration. Because if we're in making those decisions.
Exactly.
We can shape how it shows up. Easier.
Exactly. So like to that end, like that was why I wanted to ask you the question about brown girls, because, you know, I remember when we first started to get like the pushback mm-hmm. around that. And I was like, okay, we get to be focused on who we're focused on. Like,
that's fine.
Yeah, inclusion doesn't include everybody all the time.
Yes.
And so we are focused on brown girls, but that doesn't mean that brown boys or brown trans people or white folks don't have an opportunity to donate, to show up as allies, to still apply for a lot of the money that we give away.
I tell people that all the time, because there has been a big push recently for us to consider boys mm-hmm. in what we do.
Well, we've gotten that in waves.
Okay. I am not changing the name. That's not happening.
No.
But we do help boys when they fall on our radar.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And we've done things for boys in the past.
Absolutely.
You know, so it just kind of depends. And so I think it's really important to realize that just because you are not centered doesn't mean that it isn't still for you.
Yes.
You just aren't the identity that's at the center in that moment.
And I think it's educating the people who do that as well, because what they don't know is if you are a boy who wants to dance, you are 10 times more likely to get a scholarship for your full and complete training than any girl.
Absolutely. Simply because you are a boy who wants to dance.
Exactly.
That is a fact. What is one privilege you refuse to feel guilty about, but you've already done it?
I refuse to feel guilty about all of them because they are a gift.
Listen.
And I did something with it. Again, there are a whole lot of people out here who don't utilize their privileges for good.
Mm-hmm.
And they don't recognize the power that they have.
Yeah.
I recognize it every single day.
Yeah. And you use it.
And I use it.
You
and
use
I make
it.
Choices and I talk about it.
Yes.
And I make sure that it's not only people who have privileges like me that get to have a seat at the table.
So you gave a TED Talk, which I thoroughly admire.
Oh.
Mm-hmm.
Oh.
And
you will too.
It's coming.
Yeah.
And I appreciate that.
Yeah.
And what you talked about was how people were coming to Atlanta to escape discrimination and how Atlanta was creating a more equitable space.
Yeah.
I would love for you to talk a little bit about that. And then also maybe give some recommendations about what you think cities in general could do better to create more equitable spaces.
You know, it's funny because that TEDx talk was in 2019.
Mm-hmm. Still relevant, though.
And that's the painful part of it.
Yeah.
Is that it's still relevant.
It is.
You know, there's this thing that it's an index that the HRC, the Human Rights Campaign, mm-hmm. puts out every year. It's mm-hmm. it's the Municipal Equality Index. And it basically tells you how cities show up, how that infrastructure is as it relates to the LGBTQ community.
Mm-hmm.
Do they have laws that protect? And, and when you look at a city like I'm from, the privilege of being in Atlanta, where we always get 100%, 100%, right?
Yes.
But you look at the report and you just click on a city that's not even 30 minutes away.
That's right.
Like Roswell, Georgia.
That's right.
And it'll
Same
say
state.
5%.
Mm-hmm.
How is that even possible?
Correct.
So when you have people that are saying to us, why are you constantly bringing this up? Why is this always a thing?
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
it's always a thing because we don't have equity.
Yes. You can't go anywhere. You're confined to like these three little cities, right?
You can't, you can be denied in 29 states. You can still be denied housing. You can be denied that you just want to walk into a certain business and patronize it and you can't. I mean, there's so many in 29 states in this country, you're not protected.
Mm.
So I think that part of it in terms of being in an Atlanta and what can other cities do,
mm-hmm.
it's a lot easier than it's not, quite frankly.
Right.
I'll share this. One of my personal biggest pain points
mm-hmm.
is, and you see who I am and how I am. This is how I am all day, mostly every day.
Yes.
This is not an act,
no,
right?
This is you.
This is me. I'm a pretty happy-go-lucky person.
You are, yes.
When I'm out, I do this strategy thing, right? Because I immediately get anxiety if I start to feel like I have to use the restroom in public, mm-hmm. I go, oh Lord, I drank too much water. Oh no. I come up with a strategy just to use the restroom in public. And that's because I am more masculine presenting. I'm she, her mm-hmm. all day long.
Right.
Was born that.
Right.
But I present a different way.
Right.
So when I head to that restroom, mm-hmm. there's gonna be someone who comes out that says, you're going to the wrong restroom. Mm-hmm. And then I say, no, I'm a woman. And then they say, no, you're not.
Ooh. Once you figure out what your privileges are, then the question becomes, what do you do with them?